Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening and welcome to Yada Yada. My pleasure to be with you. We've got Kirk and JB here. And guys, I've got a question for you. Have either of you seen the History Channel's presentation of the Vietnam War?
Oh, yes.
No.
Yeah, so about 3 out of 9 so far.
It's playing again. Now, I've seen it once. I watched it in the background today. I got a real treat today, by the way. I was introduced to Satan today. You might think you are a really weird guy. That's funny. I've been translating Yashaya. Starting the first chapter, made it through now the ninth and about halfway through the tenth now. And I've been doing it because I wanted to find absolute confirmation that the Whore of Babylon, the Christian Church, mm-hmm. Satan, were all one and the same. Mm-hmm. And I knew that in the 14th chapter of Yashaya, we get to meet Satan. And God explains exactly who Satan is. And, you know, all the way along, we've been told, what the Lord is doing, trying to present himself as God. Well, I didn't expect the actual introduction to Satan to be, and I'm in the 10th chapter now, halfway through it, until the 14th chapter. So I've been slugging along, and there in the, right in the middle, and a series of passages I actually wanted to pass over was the introduction to Satan. He's introduced as an Assyrian king. And he explains, he explains exactly, he gets this big speaking role. It's like 5 or 6 really long verses is a speaking role. He gets a speaking role, and he explains who he is and what he's doing and why he's doing it.
Really?
And it's Satan.
Wow.
He even refers to himself as Almighty God. Yeah, it's
it doesn't surprise me, but it's right there in Yashaya.
Yeah, and it's it goes on to talk about how Satan brags and says, and I did all of this, and I stole their potential, I stole their lives, I stole everything that was valuable, and not one person lifted a finger to stop me. Not a single person spoke out against me. I thought about that for a while. They would say, what about the Inquisition? They were after Satan and then the witch hunts and go to any church and they're speaking out against Satan. No.
None.
They're speaking out in favor of Satan and against the adversary designation. He doesn't want to be known as the adversary. Oh, no, he's Almighty God. And then at the end of it, God chirps in and says, no, what in the world is the implement doing raising itself up and glorifying itself? Well, Satan's an implement.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fascinating. I had no idea that that was going to occur. So it was a fun day for me because I got to meet. I was introduced to Satan. You know, months before I was going to meet him. I thought I was going to get to meet him. You know, I laugh about this, and most people wouldn't do that. But the reason I laugh about it is that I don't think much of Satan.
No.
I know that a lot of people, religious people in particular, you know, make this huge big deal of Satan and all that sort of thing. And my only interest in Satan is how he manifests himself as the god of religion. And so I do enjoy getting to know his tactic and his approach because you see it manifest. He's the lord of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enjoy him from that point of view. So I'm here, I'm laughing as I'm getting to know Satan because Satan doesn't scare me. Yeah, he's not an obstacle. Anyway, I asked about the Vietnam War, and the reason I asked about it is this following. It is extraordinarily poignant. This story is told from the lives of the widows and the men who were either there or lost their husbands there. And they talk about, like the last thing was on just before the show began, was Hamburger Hill. And they charged a fortified position on this top of this hill that at the time only had a number. And the hardest thing to do from an infantry point of view is to charge a fortified position, particularly going uphill against a fortified enemy. And they charged the hill, and they lost, you know, scores of men. And they dropped napalm and bombs and everything imaginable, even hit some of their own men with napalm.
Mm-hmm.
And after all the losses, after all of the battling, they finally prevail, and they just walk up to the top of the ridge because the Viet Cong had gone. The Viet Cong didn't care about the hill. Hill was meaningless to them.
So
Americans finally walk up to the top of the hill. They've carried away all of their dead in the helicopters. And after they've done that, they realize, you know, that hill didn't mean diddly squat to anybody. And they left the hill, and within a month, the Viet Cong were right back there on the top of the hill, hoping that America would come and play the same game all over again. And somewhere along the way, as you listen to that show, how is it that people can still be patriotic? Why do they think their military accomplished anything for them, that we owe them a debt because they fought for America's freedom? I mean, the whole thing was a lie.
We were free before they started fighting.
Yeah. We were free before they started fighting.
Vietnam was never a threat to America's freedom.
Never an issue.
Because we were so in debt, we had to pay for the debt of the war.
Mm-hmm.
But the politicians knowingly and deliberately lied. You know, and one of the things that was so sad about the thing is the anti-war protesters were threatening and harassing the servicemen who went. It's not their fault. Now, if they're a colonel, captain, or admiral, or general, give them hell. But if they're below that rank, it's not their fault. They didn't come up with a stupid idea that we should go over there and nation build. You know, our announcement was we have to fight because every nation ought to be able to choose their own destiny. We had no interest in Vietnam choosing its own destiny.
No.
We wanted to impose what we thought was right and to stop what we thought was wrong. It's all about politics. And on the whole, God-forsaken, affair. Sacrificed almost 60,000 American lives, and all we did was make a bad situation worse. All the while, our government and our military lied to us, and yet there aren't even 1% of Americans that recognize that, that are willing to say, no, I'm not going to salute the flag. No, I'm not going to stand at attention as you play the national anthem. No, I'm not going to go along with this, we owe our servicemen a great debt, that I swear allegiance to my country. I need to be patriotic. What more do you need to know that you ought not trust your government, that you ought not depend on your military, that your military does not fight for your freedom? Oh, I know what you need. You need Afghanistan. But you didn't learn from that either. Oh, then what you need is Iraq. Well, you made another bad situation worse, but you didn't learn from that either. How about Libya? Want to try Syria? To continue to do the same thing with the support of the American people affirms that we are indeed insane. Yeah, there's a reason. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I say, don't you think it proves that dumbing down our education?
Yeah.
The last generation is because at least during the Vietnam era, they were burning the flags. They were burning their uniforms. They didn't get a reception home of how wonderful they were. And they were drafted. I mean, I was drafted. They didn't take me because they asked me. I didn't know that till I got on the bus and went home. But my whole life for several years was waiting for that event, you know. And nobody was into it. I couldn't find any reason to go other than they put me on the line.
Nobody in their right mind. If you wanted to go, shame on you.
Yeah.
You know, I was listening to Thursday Night Football, and they were talking in the booth about Pat Tillman ought to be in the Hall of Fame because of his great sacrifice for America. Bull crap! He didn't make a sacrifice for America. What he did was stupid. He bought the vomit and choked it down.
He drank the Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm. I think it's vomit. Our government is telling us is vomit. And he choked it down. And he went over there. Oh, he was going to be patriotic. He was going to teach those Muslims a lesson. He was killed by his own men. And then his own military covered it up and lied about it. Nothing heroic about that.
And what up, right?
It was a recruitment tactic.
Oh, God. It's despicable.
You want to know another insight that I got from watching one the other night is they were interviewing the Vietnam general, and he said when we sent him down there the first time, he said he'd been in the jungle for 20 years fighting because, of course, they were fighting the French before us.
Right.
He said the first time they go into a battle, they're scared to death, and the first time they kill somebody, they're sickened beyond belief. He said, but the second time, it becomes usual. The norm. And then he said by the third or fourth time, they absolutely enjoy it. And he said he never really grasped, could get a hold of that in his brain, because being in the jungle, he said the tiger kills for food, but men will
kill for fun.
They kill and mutilate, and they love it.
For fun. Right.
And they flipped the coin, and they did the same thing from these guys from Minnesota and Wisconsin who were drafted. Got them as fine little Christian boys who went to church every Sunday and walked the old lady across the street, good old boys scout type. They didn't want to go. They wanted to go. They interviewed them. He said they didn't want to go. They wanted to go to Canada, but they didn't think they could do it without bringing shame to their family, so they went. And they went over there, and he said, and they described the events exactly the same way. The first one was horrible. The second one was the norm, and after a while, it just became kill them.
A game.
Nathalem. I mean, it turned them into it. It was just sickening to watch these things because it was very straightforward.
Patriotism manufactures monsters. That's what it does.
Yeah.
Calloused monsters. And it's it is such a shame. And you know, in Vietnam, you'd say for the soldiers, listen, if you were a soldier in Iraq or Afghanistan, shame on you. You volunteered. That was moronic. That's why so many of you are committing suicide. But, you know, in Vietnam, the majority of soldiers in Vietnam did not volunteer. They were drafted.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, there were all sorts of ways out of that war. But that's where, you know, the parents of what were called the greatest generation, they failed their sons. They failed
mm-hmm.
them. Like you said, they went because they didn't want to bring shame to their family. Shame on their family for allowing them to go.
I would have told them, go to Canada.
Go.
Hell with it.
Go anywhere.
Anywhere. If you can't get into the National Guard or whatever, you go get into college and you can go. Leave. We're not in danger.
No. No threat to America in Vietnam.
Mm-mm.
We had no right to be there. We made a bad situation worse. And far worse in the, of course, the Middle East. Somebody wrote in the chat room, thank you for your service for effing up the Middle East. America didn't cause the Islamic world to be screwed up. Islam screwed. This is what caused the Islamic world to be screwed up. America simply exacerbated the problem.
Yeah, we gave them opportunity.
Opportunity, and we took away the despots that were able to somewhat control the mess. Mm-hmm. And then we gave them stunning amounts of weapons, and all of a sudden we've got 5 million, 6 million refugees who are poisoning every other country they go to. Million people dead. You know, you look at the cities that America claims that it achieved victory in eliminating the Islamic State. They eliminated the cities. There's nothing of them left.
There's nothing to claim victory over.
You know, and this is worse than what we did in Nazi Germany when we would use sulfur to firebomb and wipe out entire cities. The Germans were capable, even with their men either dead or hauled off into the Soviet Union, they were capable of rebuilding. And they did. The Muslims aren't.
Mm. They don't really make anything, you know. I know you know.
No, those cities are absolutely destroyed.
No.
What did we achieve? And we didn't deal with the disease. Still there. In fact, we've imported that disease around the world.
Mm-hmm.
We know that we only have 10 years left before the tribulation begins. It's obvious of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It couldn't be stopped if we all were given the keys to NBC, ABC, CNN, CBS, Fox. If we were given the keys to every broadcast medium,
mm-hmm.
given ownership of the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Couldn't turn it around. You really can't.
We couldn't turn it around. God himself can't turn this around. It is go ahead.
I said it's just a matter of time now.
It's a matter of time. The deck is stacked. Mankind has made such a mess of it, and it cannot be resolved. And the worst thing is that the biggest impediments to the resolution happen to be the religions that claim they speak for God.
Yeah.
They're the problem. And, you know, for Christianity, it's seminal, what they would call Old Testament verification, justification, authorization statement would be, I say, Isaiah 9:6, which they think somehow managed to do away with the entire Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Man, that was fulfilled. The Son was given to us.
Yes.
All over now. Oh, and the government is going to be on his shoulders. And he's going to be the Prince of Peace. He's going to be the Eternal Father and Almighty God. And, you know, it is extraordinarily easy to mistranslate 9:6 and 9:7. First, we've had it drummed into our heads. I would think that the majority of people could actually cite much of it from rote. And second of all, if you look up any of the words in any one of the dictionaries or lexicons, every one of them will list among the definitions the word that is parroted in every Bible publication. As a matter of fact, I went through, and with every statement, I took like 20 different Bible translations and said, this is how they rendered it.
Yes.
And so it's extraordinarily easy to mistranslate. When I did this verse 10 years ago, I mistranslated it. Because you can go to the words, look them up, and you'll find a justification for it. And it's so drummed into your head, you can't imagine that it's not speaking of Yosha. But when I got through with it, I just, you know, so many things in the past, I just shook my head and said, how could I have been so stupid? Because, guys, even with the really crappy English translations of Isaiah 9:6 and 9:7, you've got to be a dope to believe that it's talking about the Christian Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Because, guess what? The kingdom was not on his shoulder. You can't put a kingdom on the shoulder. That's the mythical god Atlas had the world on his shoulder, but kingdoms don't fit on shoulders. And he didn't rule anything. As a matter of fact, last time I checked, the kingdom that was power in Yehudah, in fact, throughout that whole region, was Rome, and they crucified him. So if the government was on his shoulder, he didn't handle it very well. And it can't be on his shoulder going forward, because guess whose shoulder? We're told that it is, well, not whose shoulder, but guess whose kingdom is being established when God returns?
That would be doomed.
And that would be doomed, by the way.
So the moment you see the government will be on his shoulder, full stop. Can't be Jesus. Patron of peace. Or they don't use patron of peace. They use the Prince of Peace. Is there any way in the world, anyway, that you could justify calling, and we'll use the Christian term, Jesus a prince?
No.
Was his daddy how do you call him a prince?
You can't.
You can't. You can't even call Dode a prince, so the prince term's got to go out the window. And by the way, Sar is much more comfortable being translated military officer, general, government leader, ruler. Dode was all those things. But also Sar happens to be the services right there in the middle of Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has...
Yeah. And it's like nothing in every lexicon, by the way.
Right. And by the way, one statement that Yosha made that is repeated three times in the Christian New Testament. The one statement that he's made that's repeated three times is, I did not come to bring peace.
Change. Yeah.
But instead, division. How could he then be the Prince of Peace?
Yes, that's the answer to that one.
Now, how can a child be born if he is supposed to be acquainted with the Eternal Father? If he's born, he can't be eternal.
No. God ain't born. God ain't died.
Yeah, and how can he be the Son and the Father when he spoke to the Father?
That's right. And he
bowed down. When he said, put everybody's attention to the Father, how in the world can you think he's the Son
mm-hmm.
when he spoke to the Father?
He directed you away from him to the Father. Now, what else do you want?
Yes. Even with the crappy English translations, translation is too kind a word, you have to be either ignorant, and very few people are ignorant of Isaiah, Yeshayah 9:6, or irrational, unthinking. So it's not hard to figure out that it can't be speaking of Yehoshua just by reading it in English and doing so with an open mind. That, however, is extremely difficult to do because religion is so pervasive, so corrupting. Very difficult to pull yourself back and think something through with an open mind. And the other problem that's hard, even for us, I think, is that once we have come to know who Yosha is, that Yosha is a identity designation and a mission statement, that Yosha is exactly what the name Yahweh chose means, Yahweh saves.
Right.
That then you begin to have a sense of appreciation for Yosha. He was the perfect Passover lamb. You know, his soul endured matzah for us. We owe him our eternity, our lives. Mm-hmm. However, all he really is for a while, for 3 years, he was not born as God. That part's clear. All you got to do is read what Yeshayah says several times about him. In fact, there's four different places in Yeshayah that affirms he was not born as God. That he was only the human manifestation of Yahweh that set apart from him and diminished for 3 years. And he actually came only for 3 days. And the entire experience was for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Yahweh using his soul. Now, when we say Yahweh's soul, I want to be really careful here because there's the implication because we think of our soul. Our soul is the embodiment of our character. It's the embodiment of our consciousness. It's the embodiment of our personality and our proclivities. And you know, our soul, we are our soul. You know, when our soul is gone, we're gone. And so when we say soul and we think of our soul is our very essence.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true for Yahweh. Yahweh had to have, though, a soul that he created
for that hour.
For that particular purpose.
For that
right,
very
hour.
Specific
Absolutely.
Purpose.
Yep.
That very specific purpose. Right. Yeah, and Roy has come to the conclusion that Gabriel's responsibility with Miriam
mm-hmm.
was to provide Yahweh's soul. Now think of it, not that's not an essence of Yahweh, it's something Yahweh created for this purpose, but to convey that soul to Miriam. And you know, that's a big responsibility. And that so Yosha was born with this soul from Yahweh. That's why Yosha's mannerisms, his persona, mirror that of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
They have the same personality, if you will, with his Yahweh soul. The thing that is interesting, and I know because I know there's also discussion about, well, this is about Dode 9:6 and 9:7, and we're going to get into it here back in a moment. That maybe Dode had the same soul. And I don't think
that's a big problem there.
That's a big problem.
That's our reincarnation, and that ain't going to happen.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem is that, well, two. One is that Dode's personality and Yosha's personality were night and day different.
Very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And their words were the same.
Well,
but
yeah.
Their personality is night and day. And the personality is night and day different. And it would defeat the whole purpose. The reason that Yahweh loved Dode more than Yosha is that Yosha was really Yahweh himself. It'd be self-love.
Yes. Well, yeah, I made a note on that, too. I said, otherwise, he's just loving himself.
Right.
And he says, I love
with
Dode,
he created the entire universe, authored life, gave man the Nesama, authored the Torah, engaged with humanity for the express purpose of enjoying the relationship that he had with Dode.
Mm-hmm.
Dode is the crescendo of the entire human experience. It's not self-love. It's Yahweh created a being that chose to know him and love him and relate to him, and they had a marvelous time together. It's what, in essence, the truth about Yashaya, Isaiah 9, 6, and 7 is, and we're going to get back into it here now.
Okay.
Is it because it cannot be Yosha, cannot be the Christian Jesus Christ. It absolutely destroys Christianity. And it destroys Christianity not because it cannot be Jesus Christ, but because of who it is. Because Dode is the ultimate antidote for Christianity. He's the anti-Paul. Dode proves that everything Paul said was a lie. He proves that the Torah is the means to salvation. He proves that the Torah liberates. He proves that the Torah doesn't condemn. Dode is the antidote for proving Christianity.
He always said it would.
Right. Right, and the very fact that not only in Jeremiah 31 do we find out that when Yahweh returns, he's going to literally install a perfect copy of his Torah teaching inside of us, meaning that this notion of a New Testament is rubbish. Well, now we have in the seminal event statement for Christianity. It's a proof statement, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We have it saying no. It's all about Dode. It's what Dode did. It's what Dode said. It's about the relationship with Dode. Is the reason that it's Dode's kingdom that is being reestablished. Dode's seat of honor. What does that mean? Dode ruled with the authority of the Torah. So it is, in fact, just devastating for Christianity. And for us in this covenant family, it is extraordinarily reassuring.
Yeah.
Because over the last 5 years, we have become Dode-centric. You know, we've 5 years of reveling in the life and words of Dode.
Well, even if it were not a choice, it's the only place you can find out so much information. I mean, it's, you're driven there regardless. I mean, even if you didn't want to go first and you found out later, it's
right.
who left us the information we need? I mean, on how to Shemar Torah to that degree.
Don't.
He's the example.
Yeah, he's the example. I mean, it is true that Moshe is a remarkable individual. But we meet him, he's 80 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He spends his entire time herding wayward sheep across the wilderness. And really all we get to know about him is what he was like when he and Yahweh first met. And then how he distilled the Torah's message and repeated the important parts in the Devarim. Dode, we get to see Dode from a boy growing up to, you know, his brave act against Goliath, to him being hunted down by Saul, to Yahweh saying, he's my guy. We see Yahweh said, he's my son, I am his father. And we have 100 Psalms, 25 Proverbs, and endless stories, and Samuel chronicles the kings and throughout the prophets. He's everywhere.
There's very little of his life we don't know.
Yeah. If there's parts that we don't know, they don't really have any value. You know, we even know how many wives the guy had. Reasonable facsimile of the number of wives that he had. I mean, yeah, we know details. We know when he made a bad decision.
Yeah.
We know the consequence of bad decisions. You know, we see Dode up close and raw. One of the things that I like so much about the stories and the Torah prophets, and that's why so many people get them wrong when they say, you know, this person did that, therefore we should do that. Like, you know, somebody fell on their face and bowed down before God, so we should do that. No, that's what that individual did. It's a flawed individual.
God never told him to.
Yeah, didn't tell him to. Told him to get up. And so, you know, we would probably be unwise to follow Dode's example and see if we could put together a harem. Probably wouldn't be good. Probably a really bad idea to have a general in the military killed because we want to have sex with his wife. You know, there are a lot of things that we ought not to. We ought not, if God gave us three choices, choose the choice that leads to the death of 70,000 people, when all we had to do is have a little quiet time out in the wilderness for a matter of a few weeks. You know, Dode made some dumb decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, the guy was brilliant.
Well, I like how you put it. You know, whose example can we follow? Can we be like Yahusha?
Not a prayer.
Can we be like Dode? Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. We can.
Well, you can guide sheep and teach forever.
Forever.
Yahusha didn't really do that.
Forever.
He wasn't a shepherd. He had a job. He did it. And you can't do that.
Yeah.
It was done in the perfect, right? It was one and done.
What is Dode's legacy to us? It's that he studied the Torah and he wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
He studied the Torah, thought about it, came to understand it, and wrote about it. Huh. We can do that, can't we?
Yeah, we do it every, yeah. All week.
We do that every time.
Yeah, but we're doing. We can do that. And not only can we do that, it's what God loves about Dode and what he enjoys about us. You know, you want God to pat you on the back and say, hey, you know, good job, JB. Good job. Well, it's going to have to be YB. He doesn't have a J. Good job, Captain.
I'm okay with that.
Nicely done.
Yeah, you almost got three of them right.
Yeah, you know, that's what you need to be doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you don't have to be perfect. Just willing.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go over a little bit of where we were on 9-6, and we'll move on to the new stuff. For indeed, because truly and surely, emphasizing this statement and to show a contrast with what has come before, while conveying causation to reveal the reason he exists, while also demonstrating how these things may appear simultaneous, even to overlap, while in actuality they transpire in an entirely different time. A child, an ordinary boy, who grows up to become a young man, was born. He was conceived and brought forth through a woman impregnated by his father, arriving among us and near us. Love you. A son, a male descendant, the offspring of a mother and father, was provided and placed near us for a limited period of time. He was given for our benefit, was appointed and bestowed for us, and he was devoted to facilitating our approach. Now, all of that is true about Doug.
Mm-hmm.
It can be fit for Yoshin. It's one of the things that got right about 9-6 years ago. You know, it says that a child was born, the son was given, God was not born. Well, got that part right. That part I didn't get right.
No.
It doesn't apply to Yoshin.
One.
What if it did? That part would be right. But, you know, Dod was born an ordinary boy, and he grew up to become the son of God. And you might say, wait a minute, no, that's you. No, Dod was the son of God.
Yeah.
Well, how do we know that? God said, he is
Doesn't
my son,
he
I
is
am
my
his
son.
Father.
The Lord.
Yeah.
God.
But God himself said, he is my son, I am his father. Yeah. He was the son of God. I don't know how to make it any more straightforward than that. And so here was a guy, you know, born, started life as a shepherd, born the ordinary way, and he became the son of God and was set before us so that he could facilitate our approach.
Well,
now, this then
know,
leads...
The least of his household, too. They didn't even tell Samuel he was out there until he said, where's the other one?
Yeah, but
surely this is not it. I mean, so he wasn't really highly thought of in his own family. So that's encouraging.
Yep. Now, there are two different periods of time that 9-6 and 9-7 speak of. One is 3,000 years ago, and the other is, 16 years, 17 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
There are, guess how many indications of this man's purpose in each of those two sets, the 3,000 years ago and the 16 years from now. How many statements does Yahweh make about him in each of these two? You count them?
Must be hundreds.
No. Just in Yeshaya 6.
Oh, just in
Yeshaya. And then again in Yeshaya 7. How many indications of what made this man unique and important to us did God include? The answer is 7, both times.
7?
Oh, the 7. Okay.
7, both times.
Okay, I see where you're going now. Okay.
And in the first group, the first two are a child, ordinary boy, was born. The second is a son. He was placed before us. Okay? So those are the first two. The third. And the means to engage and endure, ha, misra, with regard to the person being written about and what we should desire to learn from his mindset while simultaneously encouraging us to question the who, what, why, and how of our empowerment and liberation, our ability to persist and persevere, or alternatively, and unlikely, you could say, and the government, and or dominion. Now, the reason that I don't think there's a one chance in a jillion that it is government or dominion is that, misra, just misra. Yeah, ha is the definite article, misra. How many times does misra appear in the entire Torah, Prophets, and Psalms?
Once or twice? Probably
twice.
Once.
No,
twice.
Okay. Once in 9-6, once in 9-7. So in only one place. In one
so it's rare to say the least.
So it is, its definition lies in 9-6 and 9-7. That is all the only time it's ever used. It is a word conceived to speak about the Son of God. 9-6 and 9-7. That is the only place it is used. And so the first thing you would do is say, all right, either ma or me before a word is really common in Hebrew. Let me give you a great example of one. Mishpat. It's the idea of questioning, posing, trying to ascertain an understanding of the means to execute good judgment. How about mikra? It's the verb is kara, but what's the me doing in front of it? Well, that's for us to ponder the implications, the who, what, why, and when, and how of the invitations. So the me and ma, both my and ma and Hebrew and mh in Hebrew, me and ma are very unique forms of interrogatories, posing the question of who, the who, what, why of something. And so this is the me that says, you ought to ponder this, you ought to consider this, you ought to ask the who, what, and why questions regarding the verb that follows.
Okay, which
because they're all written on, let's inquire about this verb. The verb is Sarah.
Sarah, yeah.
That's the verb, Sarah. Well, Sarah is a really common verb, and it's a verb that sits in the heart not only of the mother of the covenant, but it sits here in the heart of Israel. And what does it mean? To engage, to endure, to be liberated, to be empowered. Now, it can also mean to contend with and to struggle with. And, you know, and the reason it means those two different things, a light and dark side, is that Yisrael would experience both of those things. They would, many would contend and fight and wrestle with God, still are doing it. And others would exist and endure with God, would engage and endure with God, be liberated and empowered by Him. And so it covers all of those thoughts. And therefore, it's not the government, because how many governments did God endorse? Worldwide, for all time.
Doad?
You have Doad and his son, Solomon.
Doad and Solomon, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Doad and Solomon, right. Mm-hmm. Those, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
How many countries did he endorse a government in?
Israel.
One. Yeah, one. And then I would ask you, did he make any comments regarding government in general?
Couldn't stand them.
Condemned them.
Yeah, in fact, that whole, we devoted an entire chapter to Samuel when Samuel says,
you want to be a king.
I have failed you miserably. They're asking for me to resign, and they want to have a king over them. I feel so bad about this. I failed you. And Yahweh says, no, you don't understand. By them wanting a government and leaders, they're rejecting me, not you. And then he goes through and lists all of these things that governments do that are horrible. And basically, it gets down to they rob you through taxes. They take your sons and put them in the military. They build weapons of war, and then they deploy them for the gratification of the king, and then they keep the whole system going by bribing those in positions of power. That's what he basically says. So God's not going to establish a government. Yeah, it's okay. It's the seat of honor and the reign of Doad. But the reign of Doad just says, what that means is the kingdom of Yisrael is back united. It was only united under Doad.
Yeah.
And that their enemies are vanquished. And that Doad and Yahweh are living side by side on Zion and Moriah. And that it's just a marvelous set of circumstances of the celebration of the Torah and everything it represents and the covenant relationship. I mean, that's what it means. It's not talking about establishing a government with rules and regulations, no. It's just
can I share a little something?
Reuniting. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, you know, I had Mishra, and then I went to Sarah, and then that's when I said, okay, dominion and government is not what he's looking for. He's talking
right.
about striving and so forth. So then I looked
right.
up Sar, which is the root, and uh-huh. that's turning of the head by, you know, a S and an R. That's turning of
right.
the head by teaching, instruction, and guidance.
Huh.
And then
yeah,
I looked up Mishra. Yeah,
right.
also. And then I looked up 491 again, Mishra, and looked at the letters, which were Mem, Shemek, Rosh, and He, which could easily be the power to turn observers to the upright engaged pathway, which is not too hard a stretch to look at that because that's what they're all facing the right way, doing the right thing with
right.
The set apart spirit starting
yeah.
out. And then with Sarah, yeah. I said, well, let's go look at Sarah again. And, of course, she's nourishing words. nourishing
right.
words towards the one observant that results
right.
in the one standing upright. So,
right.
any way you can get around it, government just ain't it. So
it is. Now, I want to tell you, and I wrote this in the chapter. The chapter's mm-hmm. finished. I think you'll probably have some more comments on it, and we'll continue to fine-tune it as I get more comments from more people.
Mm-hmm.
But at least the heavy lifting of the chapter is done. One of the things that I said is that, you know, if the world wants it to be government, let it be government. Because if it's government, then my case is made. It's just, it's over. If it's government, then the government will be on Dode's shoulders.
That's right. That's right.
Not Yosha's. The government was not on Yosha's shoulder. He was crucified by the government. And it will not be on his shoulder because the second half of this says the government's on Dode's. You know, it's reestablished. It's
touché.
The Dode's kingdom. So if
very
it
good.
Is government,
yeah.
then I win.
Then just who's so, government.
Yeah. Right. And it is it absolutely is not Jesus, and it is absolutely Dode if it's government. So, you know, if somebody wants to play that game, fine. Let it be government.
Let the debate begin. Or end.
Yeah, the debate
it's
over.
A heads I win, tails you lose situation.
Yeah,
that is correct.
Exactly.
That is correct. You, Christianity loses either way. Now,
yeah.
it isn't government. Now, I would just love to say, okay, well, it's over now. It's over anyway. Why don't we gain something from it? And you know, all you have to do is look up the words, look up the verbal root,
mm-hmm.
and you recognize that this is about pondering the means to engage and endure. Well, engaging and enduring is all about, that's the purpose of the covenant. It's the purpose of the Torah. And who taught us more about how to engage and endure? Okay, now, the next thing it says, and shall exist. Okay, Haya, no problem with that. But then you have Al Shechem. Now, if you look up Al Shechem, what's the first word that they give you to define Shechem?
I'm going to it now.
Shoulder.
Oh, yes.
Shoulder.
Shoulder.
You can't put a government on your shoulder, and you can't put the means to engage and endure on a shoulder. So is there anything else that Shechem can mean? What happens if you look up the root of Shechem? You know the root of Shechem, the verbal root of Shechem? You know how hard it is to find? It's Shechem.
Yes, yeah.
You know how it's, you know what the difference is in the spelling of Shechem and Shechem?
Is there?
Nothing.
What's the difference between Shechem and Shechem and the text of the great Isaiah scroll?
I don't think there's any. It's three letters.
There's no difference at all.
That is correct.
Yeah.
There is no difference. So, finding the verbal root, is it hard to do?
No.
No. It happens to be the next word up.
Name. No.
Okay. So, what does Shechem mean? And, you know, I looked this up, and it was all of a sudden, the pieces just fell into place. So, the means to engage and endure shall exist upon the continued succession of events which transpired on his ridgeline. It is Al Shechem who? His. Well, he had a ridgeline, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We call it Moriah.
Moriah.
And it's the succession of events that occurred there that provide the means to engage and endure, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what the verb means. The verb means in conjunction with and on account of his repetitive work. And the eagerness in which he pursued his calling early in his life, especially his passion to shoulder and not shirk responsibility on his elevated mountain range, being diligent, persistent, willing, and enthusiastic. From Shakam, the ability to rise up early in the day, to passionately pursue one's work, and to do something over and over again. I would call 100 psalms over and over again. How about you?
Yes, sir.
You know, by the time you've painting, Kirk, you've done it. By the time you've written, 100 pieces of code, you've done it over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
It took a while, but
most people know that the thing that made Dode special was his passion. I'm not one of those that thinks that Dode's passion is the thing that was his most defining characteristic. But it certainly was one of his defining characteristics. The man had passion. You know, that's why Yosha speaks of the Laodicean Ecclesia and says, because you have no passion. You're not hot. You're not cold. You're just blah. Yeah, I was going to vomit you out. Passion means a lot to God. God's passionate. And so Dode was passionate, yeah. I mean, I don't think it was his greatest characteristic. I think it was his intellect. But it was certainly one of his great characteristics. Shakam speaks of passion, enthusiasm. It speaks of being persistent, diligent. Now, I want to tell you, writing 100 Psalms, 25 Proverbs, and doing all that he did, he was persistent.
That's diligence.
Yeah, and the guy, as a shepherd, got up early in the morning, but almost everything he did that is germane to engaging and enduring with God, he did early in his life. And it all occurred on that ridge line that we know as Moriah. So, and the means to engage into and endure, Misra, with regard to the person being written about and what we should desire to learn from his mindset, while simultaneously encouraging us to question the who, what, why, and how of our empowerment and liberation, our ability to persist and persevere, alternatively, I'll take it if you want to believe it's government or dominion. Now, it's a contraction of me, and I would encourage people to look up me. That means to ponder, to question, to learn about something, to simultaneous, to view the simultaneous nature of something. And then, of course, Sarah. Is and shall exist. Now, most of the verbs are not imperfect in this. This one has ongoing implications. Literally, ongoing active, call imperfect active. Upon the continued succession of events which transpired on his ridgeline, El Shakam, in conjunction with and on account of his repetitive work and the eagerness which he pursued his calling early in his life, especially his passion to shoulder and not shirk the responsibility on the elevated mountain range. That's Dode. I just think that was one of the... And as soon as you get through that one, you say, wow. You know, it's the existing translations cannot be right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no chance whatsoever that they can be right. And then we did a show, you know, a week ago where we went through the names of the people that Time Magazine thinks are more important than Dode. He was 40 or 57th, I think, on the list. We'll pass over that. Then this is what happens next, as we're told. Then his designation and renown. That's from Shem. Now, most of the time when Shem is used, it means name.
Name, yeah.
But it doesn't always mean name. Sometimes it's designation and renown, reputation. If there are no names following it, then and they are attributes or descriptive characteristics of someone, then should you define Shem as name or designation and renown?
Renown.
Yeah, of course. It's not hard to figure this out. You know, you can't say his name is and then have no names. Look up Shem. Designation and renown.
And these are the characteristics.
Reputation, of right.
Yeah, that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the next is Kara. Yeah, it's Kara. Mm-hmm. And it's Kara, we're back to the perfect. Was read, recited, and designated as. Was read, recited, and designated as. A counselor providing advice, which is outstandingly brilliant and extraordinarily insightful. A valiant and heroic individual with a prominent standing in the community of God. An eternal witness providing restoring testimony of the Father. The one who conveys and represents the official position on reconciliation and restoration, salvation, and companionship in the relationship. Well, let's look at each of those and see if this is a more appropriate way to deal with them. In Hebrew, first thing we need to do is in Hebrew, do adjectives precede nouns as they do in English, pretty girl, or do they follow the nouns as in Ruach Kodesh? They're all set apart. I follow. So, if you're going to translate Hebrew into English, do you leave it in the Hebrew order, or do you change the order to accommodate English grammar rules?
You accommodate English.
Change the order to accommodate the new language.
Want to communicate well.
Right. Now, everybody knows that does a translation, except when they came to this passage, all of a sudden they went brain dead. And so they have wonderful counselor when it's the other way around. Counselor wonderful. Yoetz is counselor. It came after Pele, wonderful. So you got to reverse them. So Yoetz. Yoetz is a counselor providing advice. It's a consultant who offers directions and thought-provoking guidance for us to deliberate. It's an analyst who proposes and reveals the purpose of the plan. A mentor who speaks out and urges those who listen to follow the directions and thinking he is presenting because it is reasonable and valuable. The counselor is an ordinary guy doing an important job. That's what this is. It's not a divine title. The set-apart spirit was never called the wonderful counselor. She provides counsel. But this is an ordinary individual. A Yoetz is a person doing a specific job. It's a counselor providing advice, a consultant who offers directions. You know, an analyst who proposes and reveals the purpose of the plan. A mentor who speaks out and urges those who listen to follow the directions he's providing because they're important. I think if you were to define how we should view Dode, it's not his king. It's not his military leader. It's not as the guy that threw the stone at Goliath. It's a counselor.
Yeah.
And in fact, if I were to pick one of those terms, I'd say a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
He's a mentor providing really important advice. Now, if you read the 119th Psalm, if you read the 19th Psalm, if you read the 91st Psalm, if you read the 22nd Psalm, the 88th Psalm, just to name a few of my favorites, his advice is certainly qualifies under the astoundingly brilliant. I mean, my conclusion is that Dode is the most brilliant person who ever lived. I think his advice on, you know, I would agree that Einstein knew more about relativity and the nature of gravity and the nature of the speed of light and the
not now.
Yeah.
David knows a lot about it right now.
Yeah, don't. Yeah, right now,
That's true.
Yeah, don't knows a lot about more about it now. He's actually.
Well, he's going to be ratcheted down when he comes back too.
Yeah, so. But you know, and why I would not. What Einstein came up with is really significantly meaningful. Really powerful. I don't like it being used to create a nuclear bomb, but I do like it being used to understand who Yahweh is, how prophecy works, and how the universe exists, and to understand dimensions. I think it's a marvelous tool, as well as understanding the nature of light.
But
on the things that in life, if God exists, if Yahweh is God, if Yahweh inspired his Torah, all of which he proved, then the single most important thing to understand is who God is, what he's offering, and what he wants in return.
Yeah, and how to avail of it, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. But nothing's more important than that. And the guy that understood that and communicated the essence of it better than not only anyone else, but better than everybody else combined, is Dode.
Mm-hmm.
Dode is the ultimate counselor providing important advice. Best the world has ever known. Well, Pelé, extraordinarily insightful, marvelous, amazing, wonderful, distinguished, set apart and separating, powerful and fantastic, which is not only prophetic, but consistently fulfilled. Yeah,
that's really the only skill set he really needs when he comes back.
Right.
Because there's no armies to fight.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's now, I would, world.
So the only two disagreements I would have here with the English Bible renditions is the order. It's not wonderful counselor. It's counselor providing advice, which is astoundingly brilliant, extraordinarily insightful. And the fact that it's not a divine title. And therefore, it should not be capitalized.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really comfortable saying it's not a divine title and should not be capitalized because the things that follow, there's only one of them that is a divine, or two of them that are divine titles, but they're both described. They both describe a human that is providing access to them, that is writing about them. So here, this is an extraordinary man doing an extraordinarily important job, better than anyone in all of human history, but he's still a man. He's the wonderful, a wonderful man, but he's a counselor providing extraordinary advice. All right, so what's the next one on the list? It is, was my favorite for just destroying Christianity. And, you know, this is the one of the group
mm-hmm.
that the religious theologians know they got wrong. At least the good ones know they got wrong. This is the one where if you look it up, they subtly, you know, way down there in the fine print, they say, you know, there are some who have noted that Gabor is used to describe, a powerful man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a divine attribute.
Mm-hmm.
So it is. And so in this case, it is, we've got Gabor following L, which means it has to be reversed in English. So it's Gabor L. And by the way, if Gabor meant Almighty, what does L mean?
Well, it can mean mighty, almighty, or mighty, powerful, strong.
Yeah, all L means is almighty or mighty one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that all it means? Mighty or mighty one? L?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's all it means. Back in the day, and in Hebrew, mighty one and almighty was the way they spoke of God, and they mm-hmm. didn't have the word, the English word God. They had a very close equivalent. They had Gad, Gad was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. But Gad did not mean God. The equivalent English term for El is God, but it literally means Almighty. So if Gabor meant Almighty, it would be Almighty, Almighty, no matter which order you put them in.
Yeah, that's awkward.
Or, yes, yeah, Mighty, Mighty One. Awkward. But we've confronted Gabor many, many times. Gabor is used when you mentioned the Nephilim. Gabor is in that category. It's absolutely talking about men. It talks about men who are champions, who prevail, who have prominent standing in the community. A Gabor is a person who prevails in a society. And is also a valiant warrior, is a Gabor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dode was a valiant warrior. He had a prominent position in the community. He was a valiant and heroic individual, no question about it. Powerful person who prevailed, a champion of God. So. This has to be applied to a person, and there's only one person who Gabor fits that was served the interests of God, and that's Dode. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Let me give you another connection.
Yeah.
With El. When you go to El, and they say go to a Yil, and then you have a Yil is a ram. It also is a pillar, a pilaster, which is the projection. Uh-huh. In a wall on each side of an entryway, which is a elite doorway, and Dode represents that. He's a leader, a chief, a lintel, and a post, an upright pillar. You know, so.
Yeah, that's true. You know,
see the elite, and you see Dode with two elites on side of a increasing wall. That's
right.
Pretty cool. I mean, that's
pretty
cool. Another little connection.
Yes. Yeah. I don't just say God automatically anymore. I don't think it says this in Strong's. The fact is that El is a contraction of Eloah. Elohim is the plural of Eloah. And we say that Elohim is the plural of El. No, really. Elohim is the plural of Eloah, and El is the contraction of Eloah.
Mm-hmm.
But the full term is Eloah. And what it means is mighty, almighty. And the contraction of it is to El, and it's usually used as Elohim, the plural of Eloah. And the plural here doesn't mean there's multiple gods. It's there was a royal we, an inclusive way of speaking. And this really reminds me of something that is interesting about Dode, is that while he was never a prince from a human perspective, he was from a spiritual perspective. If you were the son of the
Almighty
supreme
God.
Of the universe,
you're
a prince if you're a man, princess if you're a woman. Well, that's why Sarah was one of the her first name before God changed it was actually princess. So he is from that perspective. So anyway, Gabor is speaks of a valiant and heroic individual with a prominent standing in the community of God. There you go. Makes perfect sense. The next one is from Ed, and it's Ed Ob. It's actually in the text the other way around. Ob Ed. Is there any debate that Ob means father?
No.
No. Matter of fact, when I like to amplify things, and I'll put down other words. Well, sorry, dad, papa. Male caregiver provided. The fact is that Ab only means father.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it means. Father. All right. So what does Ed mean? So Ed happens to be one of the most common Hebrew words. It's all over the place. As a matter of fact, it would be hard to find more than 10 words more important than Ed and the whole Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, because Ed means eternal witness, providing restoring testimony. Ed is the first read on Ed is witness. The second read of Ed is testimony. The third read of Ed is eternal, and the fourth read is restoring. Those are the four ideas that Ed conveys. It's interesting that Kirk, you've done and JB, you've done a lot of translation. There is a number of times where we'll see odd, which is odd and ed, are written exactly the same way in the Hebrew text, used in conjunction with everlasting, but never by itself. Odd, when it's just by itself, is a preposition. The one place where odd is used, when you see odd in conjunction with eternal, as in eternal father, it's when it's combined with olam. Olam is the Hebrew word for eternal.
Forever.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what odd olam does, it just means until forever. Up to the point of eternity.
Which is a very long time. Yeah,
yeah, it just, one of the ways that Hebrew conveys infinity and eternity and everlasting is by saying ad olam. But ad isn't the word for eternal. It's just a preposition that leads us to the concept of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
Olam is the Hebrew word for eternal. This does not say El Olam. If it doesn't say El Olam, it cannot be eternal God. Or eternal, excuse me, I meant Ab, I'm reading the first one. It doesn't say Ab Olam. Yeah, it doesn't say eternal Father. It's Ad Olam or Ed Olam. Those are your choices. So it's either a preposition, and it would be the single most common translation of the preposition is until. So it's either until the Father, I don't think so, or it's Ed, transliterated Ed, which is written exactly the same way, which means an eternal witness providing restoring testimony of the Father. Well, that one is, they say, that you're cooking with gas at that point.
Yeah, I guess.
Did you find anything else that would make any sense related to Ab El, or when you get to Ed Ab, put a reverse in the order, it makes so much sense. It's so perfect.
No, that's very
okay.
Good. And it's you can extrapolate out of all this stuff. I got that. Yeah, you just have to dig a lot. I got to take a lot of notes.
Yeah, but you know, I would say that if you're not willing to examine every possible word that is comprised with the same letters in Hebrew, recognizing that diacritical markings that the Masoretes used weren't published in the text until the Masoretic text in the 11th century. That's 11th century CE. This was written 700 BCE. That's 1,800 years, 1.8 millennia. Different. So this was written without the diacritical markings, which means in the original text, it's Ein Daleth. You just have to look up, and if you're not willing to take the time to look up what words were written Ein Daleth and to consider them, then you ought not be doing this because you're not serious enough about it. And then when you find, well, here's Ein Daleth, and it's Ed, and it describes what Dod did best, that he was an eternal witness providing restoring testimony of the Father. Well, that's about as good as it gets. that point you can say, I rest my case. An observant individual providing everlasting testimony, sharing evidence which is enduring and restoring, an eyewitness conveying information regarding the perpetual and continued existence of the Father. Okay, what's the next one? This is Lasar. Now, Lasar, I'm not going to make any claims that Sar cannot be translated government official, military officer. It can be. That's not the limit of what it can be translated, but it, you could, if somebody said that is how I'm going to translate it, if the context is right, you can do that. And you should always keep in mind that, yes, that's one of the things that it does mean, but it's not all it means. Salazar, the one who conveys and represents the official position, the one who acts and delivers that which has the authority and power to prevail, which, with regard to acting on reconciliation and restoration, salvation, companionship, and relationship, shalom. Now, in this case, every English Bible translates the shalom as peace.
Mm-hmm. Always do reconciliation.
That's like asking somebody to describe a Ferrari, and they say, pretty.
Okay. What was your line?
Accurate. What was that, Kirk?
You said, so you wrote somewhere, you know, the Torah, isn't that, that's nice.
Yeah.
Quite an understatement.
I think that was the example I actually used when I was writing the chapter. Yeah, somebody can you describe the Torah to me? It's nice. That's sort of like translating shalom as peace and leaving it there.
Peace.
It does mean peace in the sense that when the relationship is reconciled, you have peace in that relationship. But it's a relationship term, and it speaks of all the things that are important in a quality relationship. It's the restoration, salvation, companionship in the relationship, the blessings of restitution and redemption, peace and prosperity, satisfaction and favor, association and friendship, health and prosperity, safety and well-being, a lacking nothing, contentment and tranquility. Great term. It's everything you would look for in a relationship. If you wanted to create a business deal that you never had to enforce, what you would do is try to shalom it. Make certain that it is mutually enjoyable, mutually beneficial, mutually prosperous, that it brings all the blessings of a relationship with it, that it's self-restoring. Then you don't have to enforce it, do you?
Hardly. Nobody walk away from that.
No one's going to walk away from that. That's what shalom says. So he was the one that conveys the official position on reconciliation and restoration, on companionship and the relationship. Oh, boy.
There's one little insight on Sar. I was looking it up, I found some, you know, I get these little things that just go here. I look it up where this phrase is used other times, you know, and I look those up. And one of this exact phrase is used in 1 Samuel 22:2, where it's describing Dod as the leader or captain over the stressed, indebted, discontented 400 men.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, that
it's a somebody that holds an official position.
It's always
absolutely
about Dod. It wasn't like it was in Moshe's time.
Right. Yeah, it cannot be Yosha.
No, it can't be Yosha.
No, the Sar would, no matter how you define Sar, it doesn't work for him. And it works for Dod, no matter how you describe it.
If y'all came back in a diminished form like Yosha, or however that's going to happen, why would he want to sit here and take on that role?
Yeah, really.
I mean,
Why? Can you imagine? Here is Yahweh saying, I love this guy. In fact, I'm going to call him my beloved. That's my name for him. I just, everything about him, I love. So you know what I want him to do? I want to take his soul and let him lay him alive and then crucify him and then let his soul go on to Sheol as if the Torah really did not restore him. I'm going to let him pay the price for all of you.
That's absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
Honest to goodness. Why would I do that to my beloved?
Not unless you're God of S&M, right?
You'd have to be.
You'd have to be.
He said he's going to do it all for us. He said, so I ain't doing this for us if he does it to Dode.
Yeah. So anyway, let's go over these again, and we'll go on to we're running out of time here, but we'll have enough time. We'll go over the list. Here's the first seven. For indeed, because truly and surely, emphasizing this statement and to show a contrast with what has come before, while conveying causation to reveal the reason he exists, while demonstrating how these things can appear simultaneous, even to overlap, while in actuality they transpire in an entirely different time. One, a child, an ordinary boy who grows up to become a young man, was born. He was conceived and brought forth through a woman impregnated by his father, arriving among us and near us. Two, a son, a male descendant, the offspring of a mother and father, was provided and placed near us for a limited period of time. The perfect conjugation. He was given for our benefit, appointed and bestowed for us. He was devoted to facilitating our approach. Three, so then with regard to the person being written about, the means to engage and endure, to be empowered and liberated, should we desire to learn from his mindset, was, is, and always shall be part of his continued succession of events, which transpired upon the ridgeline, his ridgeline, in conjunction with his repetitive work, the eagerness in which he pursued his calling early in his life, and the passion to shoulder and not shirk responsibility. His designation, reputation, and renown was read, recited, and designated as, should be invited and summoned as, was called out and welcomed as, was known and reckoned as. Number four, a counselor, tellingly brilliant advice, a consultant who offers directions and thought-provoking guidance for us to deliberate, which are extraordinarily insightful, an analyst who proposes the agenda and reveals the purpose of the marvelous plan which sets us apart, an advisor and mentor who speaks out and urges those who listen to follow the directions and thinking he is presenting because it is reasonable and valuable and wonderful, empowering and prophetic. Number five, a valiant and heroic individual with a prominent standing in the community of God, a powerful and courageous person who prevails on behalf of the Almighty, a champion, confirming the influence and strengthening nature of the Mighty One. Number six, an eternal witness, providing restoring and everlasting testimony, sharing evidence which is enduring, and conveying information regarding the perpetual and continued existence of the Father. And number seven, the one who conveys and represents the official position, the authorized and endorsed patron, who acts and delivers the sanctioned means to prevail regarding reconciliation and restoration, salvation and companionship, restitution and redemption, peace and prosperity, salvation and favor, an association based upon mutual affection and friendship, delivering health and prosperity, contentment and tranquility. Now, I put an ellipsis after that because I don't think the sentence ends there. In fact, I'm certain it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It goes on to say, tremendously increasing the ability to learn about and appropriately respond to the means to engage and endure, acting upon the capacity to be liberated and empowered. Now, we're not recording anymore, and we'll go back to this point, guys, next week. But this was probably the easiest of all of them to translate and the most screwed up in the English translations. Why did I say it's the easiest? Well, the English translations want lamb to be four. Hebrew has a word for four. In fact, it has two. Ken and key. They're used all the time. They must appear between the two of them, but they appear 1,000 times.
Yeah.
Lamb is clearly a contracted of lamad. Lamad is a Hebrew verb that appears all over the place. Very common Hebrew word. It's one of, I counted them, I think there's like 11 or 12 Hebrew words for teach.
Mm-hmm.
And lamad is a very special Hebrew word for teach. And that it describes Dode perfectly. It describes JB, you, and Kirk and I. It describes all of us, really. To lamad is to be taught and then teach what we have learned.
Yeah, that's pretty much what we do.
That's pretty much the characteristic of everybody in the family.
Yeah. Dode was Yahweh's best and favorite student. And then he became his most effective spokesman. That's what lamad means. Lamad, you know, if there's the Greek transliteration disciple, the Greek word that we translated into English to describe the 12 fellows that mm-hmm. that hung with Yosha for the 3 years.
Yeah.
It means to learn and to teach. They should have been called lamad. If we're going to translate or transliterate rather than translate a word, they should have been called Yosha's lamad. That's the Hebrew concept. It is to learn and then to teach what we've come to know and understand. Rab is an easy term, as Rab means abundantly, greatly, extensively, plentifully, abundantly, tremendously, you know, to the largest extent. Yeah, it's the basis of Rabbi. It means exalted ones. They're not. But,
no, of course not.
No. And by having the end of it, the I, Rabbi, it means my exalted. You know, it's a self-endearing term. It's what God hates. Why he, it's like Satan. You get, it's a satanic type title, Rabbi. But Rab means tremendously, abundantly, extensively, plentifully, tremendously. That's Rab. That's easy. Lam is extraordinarily easy. When you just look up the verbal root. I mean, how many times have we talked about it? There's nobody here that's a trained linguist. There's nobody here that has a PhD in Hebrew.
Yeah.
But how long did it take us to figure out, boy, if you want to understand a Hebrew word, look up its verbal root.
Yeah.
Have you ever found just going to the verb didn't work for you?
No.
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 Much more clarity.
Hebrew is a very concrete, active language.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything is defined by the verbs.
Correct. Correct. So, lam is simple. Lam is increasing the ability to learn and about and appropriately respond. Providing information and imparting instruction learned as a student, teaching how to become familiar with the guidance needed to accept. Diligently studying and then explaining a particular pattern of behavior associated with something. To be as a disciple, a student eager to learn. Taught by another, having received clear and compelling revelations so as to be prepared to intellectually convey. Contracted from Lamad. Just like El is contracted from Elohim. To teach and learn. Gaining information through instruction and then responding appropriately. Extremely easy word to define. And then we are presented again with the second of two times that Misra appears in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. So if our definition worked the first time, it has to work this time. You know, the last time it was used in conjunction with Shechem,
mm-hmm.
right? That the means to engage and endure shall be demonstrated in the successive series of events that transpired on his ridgeline.
Right.
That was Misra Shechem, Al Shechem. This time it's Misra is being modified by Lamb. Rob Lamb, tremendously increasing the ability to learn and respond to what? Hummus, or other means to engage and endure, acting upon the capacity to be liberated and empowered. Same definition works perfectly, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's when you know you're in trouble. If you're trying to define something, is that if you can't use it consistently,
mm-hmm.
if you can use it consistently, you're on the right track.
Yeah, that's good check and balance. Isn't it? Yeah, very good.
So here's the check and balance. So what is Doe doing? Now this is the second series of seven events. This is the first of not events but of depictions. And so this is the first of the second set of seven, and it's a continuation of the first, and it says that he's tremendously increasing the ability to learn about and appropriately respond to the means to engage and endure, acting upon the capacity to be liberated and empowered. And when Dode returns, for 1,000 years he's going to do that. He's not just a figurehead. He's a living embodiment of the covenant. Dode's soul, his persona, his passion was to learn and teach, right? Why do we think that he'd be any different? This says he's going to come back doing what he's always done, and he's going to be really good at it.
Really good.
He's going to do a lot of it. You know, we've got 1,000 years. We're going to be able to glean additional insights from Dode.
Oh.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's after that for eternity. Well, I don't think we will ever be as loved by God, be as close to God, be viewed as special and as dear to God as Dode. I think that Dode is going to have that position for all eternity. He earned it, and I'm glad for it. And I'm just glad to be in the same family. I think Dode's going to maintain that forever. But in terms of his teaching, I don't think Dode's going to be any more remarkable a teacher in eternity as any of the rest of us. I think we'll be on pretty much the same footing when it comes to figuring things out and exploring and sharing what we learned. So, Kirk, did you have any challenges with Lamb?
No. Yeah, I mean, just
come to the same conclusion?
Pretty much.
Contraction of Lamad. I don't even know how people got four out of it, particularly since there's two perfectly good. It's kind of like getting Eternal Father out of Odd, recognizing that the only reason that Odd even has Eternal associated with the term in lexicons is because it was used here. That doesn't mean eternal. You know, it's as it means witness, testimony. And here, Lam doesn't mean four. He and Ken mean four. It means to learn and to teach. And it's one of the things that I know I'm a cosmic killjoy when people write me, they're so excited and they want to know, you know, how they should go about sharing this with their loved ones, or they write me and say, you know, I told my loved ones about what I had discovered, and they all poo-pooed me, and my response is all the same. Why don't you take 2 years and study? Yeah, take 2 years and study. You know, you're likely to do more harm than good if you start off right at the beginning. I'm telling people what you learned. Now, I did, and maybe I shouldn't have, and because I made so dadgum many mistakes. But you know, it is hard. I want to tell you, it's hard not to want to share what you're learning. But the one thing I do tell people, if you have like Kirk, if you have just heard it from me, you and Terry heard it from me, and if you didn't do the next thing, which was to verify it, to check, then you ought not share it. You need to know it. It's got to be part of the fabric of your life. And the only way you can do that is to study it and to check and verify it and come to the same conclusions yourself. and then you're prepared to share.
Yeah.
And then you ought to expect the same level of success that, well, yeah, actually you should expect a lesser level of success than Dode and Yosha had. And they weren't very successful.
No. Nobody seems to be. That's just the nature of the beast. Yeah.
They were perfectly successful when you look at what God wants.
Yeah.
All God wants is to know it, accept it, share it. Right? When it comes to what God wants, they were perfect. God does, there's no part of that equation that says, and oh, by the way, compel others to agree with you. There's no part of that equation. God doesn't once say, you better convert them. I better see some numbers walking through that door.
That was the hard part. I thought everybody would. And a lot of people were very polite to me. I would talk, you know, with them for an hour or so, and they would seem so interested. And then they would, I'm sure they must have gone home and said, what?
Yeah, what? Yeah. I remember my last time to try to talk to somebody who was a Christian that was at this football party that I was invited to.
Mm-hmm.
And this person, I was just sitting in the back, and most people came from the same church, is why they were at this thing. I met the guy at a pizza parlor, is how I happened to be invited, and it was just way too Christian. I never went back. But, you know, I went through and spent 45 minutes with this guy walking him through, you know, everything from you can't rely on the Christian New Testament to there is no Jesus, that Paul is the plague of death, and demonstrating all of it and telling where he could go to read and how he could contact me if he wanted to have access to more information or had any questions. Do you think I heard from him?
Never.
I'd be shocked if he did.
Yeah. You know, it's just vast preponderance of people that it falls on deaf ears. And it did for Yosha, it did for Dode. It's what we did for Yashaya, it did for Yirmiya. I mean, these are guys that are getting it directly from Yahweh himself.
Yeah. They know exactly what they're saying.
Right. Yeah, they have the perfect response every time. And
still none.
That's right.
Let me ask you a question. What was the value of the disciples, as we were talking about that a minute ago when we were learning? I mean, other than they got it and some became part of the family, but, you know, from the old Christian perspective, they were really important because they wrote all these letters. We know the letters never got anywhere because they butchered them. Yah obviously didn't protect them, so they weren't that important to Yahweh. I realize there's some Matthew stuff and there's some Yohanan stuff. But they didn't. The people who followed them, according to all the Christian books, they were terrible after they, you know, the drop off went just completely left.
Yeah, I think that really all you got with the disciples is you got the book of Matthew. You know, there's a lot of things in Matthew that help us understand you know, it's all there in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, but still it's really a nice. I'm really glad we have it. I wish we had it in Hebrew. But nonetheless, I'm glad we have it. I think there's a lot of stuff in it that's really useful. There's a lot of conversations in Yahokanan that are useful, insightful.
Mm-hmm.
And Revelation is extremely important to helping us understand and piece together what is in Malachi and Zechariah and Daniel. And even what's in the Olivet Discourse in Matanyah. So I think it's got real value now.
But the drop-off between then and now is so vast. I mean, nobody's picked this stuff up.
Zero
now to you.
Zero.
Right?
Yeah, zero.
Yeah.
Yeah, zero.
And wow.
Yeah, this, you know, we didn't spend a lot of time on it, but two of the three statements, Yashaya 9, 3, and 4, are about us again.
Mm-hmm.
And this time, And there is no question it's about us.
Mm-hmm.
None. It's a lone Gentile. And when you study the concept of lone Gentile or lone individual with Yahweh, it's always a lone person, but that lone person never works alone.
No.
Moshe didn't work alone.
No.
Gideon didn't work alone. Eliad didn't work alone. None of them worked alone. Abraham didn't work alone. Jacob didn't work alone. Don't work alone. But God's going to pick a person and say, I'm going to work with this person. And you quickly find that with some explanation, you're back like Gideon, and you got 300 people around you.
Mm-hmm.
All doing the same thing for Yahweh.
Yeah.
But Yeshayah Isaiah 9, 3 and 4
yeah.
is absolutely about us. And in this time, it should be, because it's introducing this extraordinarily important prophecy about the single most important person who ever lived, Dod.
Mm-hmm.
And we may be the first people to get it right since it was written, to understand what was being conveyed and why it's being conveyed for 2,700 years. And it may be as important a revelation as anything ever said. Because it takes your attention right back to Dod and what he wrote. I mean, how could you have something
right
more important than,
right,
than the 19th Psalm, than the 91st Psalm, than the 22nd, than the 88th, than the 119th? I mean, all of those are just so magnificent. The 23rd, mm-hmm. the 24th. They are magnificent. It takes us right back there. When Yahusha was at the single most important moment of his life and made the ultimate declaration, my God, why are you forsaking me? And not asking a question, reciting from the 22nd Mizmor Psalm, which Dod wrote, he quoted Dod.
Mm-hmm.
So people would understand what's happening there. If he quoted Dod to explain what he's doing, you're right.
Yeah.
Yahusha 9:3-4 is talking directly about us, because what we're doing here really matters. And if it garners the same as Gideon, the 300 covenant members, wonderful, but that's not why Yah was doing it. We are beneficiaries by opportunistic beneficiaries. Yahweh is doing it because he made a promise to Abraham, and he's going to honor that promise, which requires Yisrael and Yahudah to wake up. And guess whose king Dod was? If we can point them away from Yahusha and to Dod, so listen.
Well, yeah. Well, it's pretty cut and dry when everything is so much is by Dod and the Torah in the Torah, and
right.
Yahusha is mentioned in there because Dod mentioned him, you know, and there's
yeah.
some references to him. But that's he left us no real record beyond that.
But
other
Dod
than these,
never once mentioned
poor historical records. Yeah.
Dod never once mentions Yahusha by name. And there's a reason for that. He mentions Yahweh by name.
Mm-hmm.
He understands that Yahusha is nothing but Yahweh doing what Yahweh promised to do.
Promised to do, yeah.
Right.
You know, the other day I looked up Yahweh, and it's all your sites, your books, and JB's mostly.
Yeah.
I couldn't find it. I was looking. I said, okay, well, there's got to be somebody else that knows this that's not twisting it or something like that, but there's got to be... And no, it's all over the place. I'm amazed. Amazed.
Mm. You know, it sounds self-serving for us to say we have come across now two places in Yahusha that are specifically speaking of us, but it isn't self-serving at all. Because
no.
We're not serving ourselves.
I don't view it that way.
We aren't serving ourselves. The people being served here are Yahweh's family.
Yeah.
And his chosen people. That's who's being served. They're not self-serving. Nothing about this is self. It's self-benefiting. Yeah, we benefit from what we learn.
Yeah, we're the greatest beneficiaries of what we learn.
Yeah. And, you know, just like the 91st Psalm, I knew the 91st Psalm was written for me. It's written for everyone who engages and does what Yahweh wants done. Doesn't diminish any aspect of it. Written for me. Yeshaya 9:3-4 was written for me and for us.
Yeah.
Now, if there's somebody else that comes along that is doing what we're doing, specifically as it relates to revealing who Dode is and what he means to us and this particular prophecy on Dode, I would be thrilled for it to apply to more than just us. That'd be great.
No, it's not jealousy factor here.
No.
Go for it. Yeah.
Go, yeah. If you feel slighted because we're saying it applies to us, I've got the remedy for that.
Yeah.
Go make it apply to you.
Go make it apply to you. That'd be really good.
Yeah.
Love for you to do that.
And not one of us is going to be complaining if you do.
Oh, no.
We'll applaud you.
Join the
club. Absolutely. We'll applaud you even if we disagree on a number of issues. So long as your defense of your positions is based upon what Yahweh said and you're not dogmatic, I will disagree. That'll be just fine.
Yeah.
There's a lot of places we're extrapolating.
Yeah.
You know, there's no place that God says specifically that the universe is six dimensions and he exists in the seventh. It's, I think you can extrapolate and say that's pretty obvious. But, you know, it's not stated specifically. You've got to figure it out.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've come to a different conclusion and it's supportable, by all means.
Did you have any idea that Dode was so prominent, say, a year ago? I knew.
A year ago, yeah.
I mean, I'd memorized the 23rd Psalm.
Once I had done the 119th Psalm.
When you covered all that, you were on pins and needles, you're, so to say.
Once you go through that one, it's obvious.
It's obvious, yeah. Then it's a lay down hand from that point on.
Yeah.
But then, you know, But what I hadn't done until this past year or so was to really delve into what's written, not just what Dode wrote, but what's written about Dode. You know, Samuel, Chronicles, Kings, Isaiah. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's just like a treasure trove, man. This has just been every... You know, I'm kind of annoyed at you because you're so far ahead of everything, but we're still working on 9. And
yeah, we're still working. We haven't made a record of 9.
We're wrapping up the middle. We're just about wrapping up 17 here.
Well, this is 17.
I know we jumped, but
we
have to jump
on
this.
All we did is jump in the middle. 17 has got some great stuff, and we skipped over a lot of the great stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But,
I'm just kidding, but
and I'm now I'm halfway finished translating 10. As I said, I spent today getting to know Satan. Didn't expect that.
Well, I really
like getting to know Satan. I mean, it's so helpful to see Satan as he is, because then you get to see how religion works.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you know, at the end of this section, where you're talking about Ephraim and Manasseh.
Yes.
And then I remember the little chart I had where they placed them on one side, and I've always said about them there, you know, they were half Egyptian coming out of the chute because he married an Egyptian wife, Yosef, and so they always had a problem.
Raised in Egypt.
Yeah, raised in Egypt. I mean, they lived there and died there. I mean, so, and then you have are those connections, and then you, when Moshe lines them up on where they're going to camp, and you've got Manasseh and Ephraim opposite the side of Judah, and they're also, he puts a pole crowd with him.
Yeah.
And you go, wow. And then you go, you track it like that, and you learn there's a big contention of when we did the Arrowy thing, and you've got England, and you've got the United States of Manasseh, or Ephraim and Manasseh, respectfully, and they're embedded with this Pauline religious garbage, you know, and it's very easy to see what he's talking about. I mean, it's just like,
I did, I did in that thing, I picked out everything that Jacob said about Ephraim and Manasseh, you know, because basically they are, so, you know, there was a lot that that he said about them, and then I translated what Jacob's blessing of
Yosef's children, Manasseh and Ephraim.
Yeah, he's given Yosef's birthright to the two, split it between the two of them. So I wrote, went through that and said, okay, you know, I wasn't quite as blunt as this is the United States or the United Kingdom, because he makes a lot of statements about them. And so you can, what I tried to do at the end of the chapter, because chapter 9 ends with a reference to Ephraim and Manasseh. And so all I tried to do is say, all right, why don't we look up and see what the blessings were of Ephraim and Manasseh? And then try to deduce, you know, just the facts from it. I didn't extrapolate it all that far. I mean, you're taking the United States and Great Britain, and it seems like that's what it's indicating to me. But I don't know. You think I should have gone further?
Well, if I was doing it, I would have. But that's I've been studying this stuff for years, and I mean, all the way from the English throne on, they did a, all the way back to, Vashti Polgart, which was, the Zorite's, son, you know, from Spain, who comes up through there, and all the way up to Brut, King Brut, are all on the family tree, and you can connect all the dots of who all these people were, and you know, it's
if you want to take the chapter and actually write what you, where you would have taken it, you know, I left it, just as, you know, here's the things that you can glean. I think they all address the U.S., but here's the things you can glean from them. But if you want to take it further, send it to
us. I'll send you a couple of notes, you know, and just on some things that seem quite clear to me and why, you know, then you can look at it and see whether it has any merit or not. But to me, it's one of those things, like, it's very hard to prove that it's not, you know. If you're debating it, I don't know I don't know how I can knock it down, because it seems so obvious. And then all the things about who's doing the wars and who's starting to, you know, to the end time.
Right.
I mean, my God, it's us. You know,
the reason I didn't take it further, and it did seem to me to be the U.S. That he was inferring, is that
it's too early in the part.
We were at, this was a 90-some-odd page chapter.
Yeah, it's big already.
That had a absolute treasure as it relates to the story of Gideon and the day of Midian.
It might be distracting.
And then the crescendo was that Isaiah 9:6-7 are about Dode. That I knew I had to address it, because it would be inconsistent with the rest of the book not to address it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just I moved on, because I, you know, I was OD'd on what we had done, and I was antsy to move on to the 10th chapter of Yeshayahu, particularly after I spent 3 days translating what God had to say about Ephraim and Manasseh, and then I realized that and I brought up a bunch of other websites, and I brought out your notes, and I said, okay, should I take this further than that? And I didn't know if I was going to do the right thing.
Well, for now, and it looks like I need to do another cover that says Volume 2. What do you know about 1,500 words?
So. Yeah, I know.
We're 1,500 pages. So.
Yeah, wow. We are. So why don't you've got the
I'll spend a little time on the side.
Why don't you spend a little bit clearer and a little more concise. Yeah, where would you go with it? Because it is one of the few times that I have not given my conclusion. I just said here's some highlights. Here's what we can know, and all I really did is restate the key points of the text. It's one of the very few times that I haven't extrapolated. This is what this means.
Mm-hmm.
I know I left that as an opening. The number one reason I did it was I was antsy. I wanted to move on to chapter 10.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, I'll play around with it. See what
you play around with it. See what you think. Yeah. The reference to 13 and arrows and eagles and all that sort of thing, you know, that's not in reference to Yosef or Ephraim or Manasseh. So, you know,
you have to go back to all the heralry, you know, where they and trace them, where they carried it for years
right.
and years and years. So, yeah, and that's a big book all by itself.
But to go there, you know, I have to write 100 pages.
Yeah, I understand.
So it's hard
to condense it just for a couple of shows. It's kind of like, oh,
that's correct. Yeah.
There's this.
Yeah. So what conclusions can we make about Ephraim and Manasseh that we can state in 2 pages or less at the end of that chapter that are based entirely on proven history, verifiable history, and Yahweh's testimony.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I'm totally interested in doing that. I know I left it open. I was hoping that you would find it a challenge and fill in the gaps. I'm having too much fun on 10.
I understand. No, I understand. I'm treading water on all the stuff you're doing, trying to keep up. So, anyway,
it's at least I'm moving reasonably quickly. It's making good progress, but spending long days at it. I mean, that's the problem is I'm not working out anymore. I come down here early in the morning. I do this all day, I do it until 10 o'clock at night, and I've been at a pace for the last few months that's not healthy. So I probably am going to have to.
Don't do that. Don't run yourself now.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to cut. But I'm enjoying it. I'm not doing it, thoroughly enjoying it, but I probably am pushing it too hard, doing too much. It's probably not the best plan right at the moment. So I'll finish 10, and then I think hopefully I'll be able to dial it back.
Let me make a quick note before you hang up. What page are we on starting back next week? Around 59 or something? Or?
Yeah, I think so. Right around there.
Okay.
Yeah. We're still in the history of English translations in the Christian New Testament.
No, I mean on the stuff tonight.
Oh, on the stuff tonight, where do we end? But that's where we are on that chapter 9. We'll pick it right back up at tremendously. This is page 67.
Okay, 67. Only because I've got a couple of copies, and some of it I've got. You know, the last one you sent me is on still.
Yeah, it's the first.
So
the opening line of 9-7.
Okay, 9-7. Okay, opening
9-7.
Okay, I can get there now.
It's just, yeah,
I got
right after we go through the. Yeah, we did the 1 through 7 points where they were actually broken down into points 1 through 7, and then we're right there on. The first statement of what is 9-7, I think it's a continuation of the same sentence myself.
Okay.
Because Hebrew sentences either begin, most of them begin with the wa, and then so, or just don't even translate it. No, that's the start of a new sentence, or can or ki. Those are the beginnings. It's a conjunction or a preposition that begin almost every Hebrew sentence. There's no preposition, no can, no ki, no wa. So that would typically indicate that it's the same sentence.
Well, don't wear yourself out, but it sure is fun to listen and get everything you said. Oh, God.
Yeah, this is really fun.
What a trip.
Having a good time.
Thank you, my friend.
Yeah, what a trip.
JB, I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, JB.
Talk to you guys.
All right. Good night.
Bye. Bye-bye.